Hello and welcome to the AMP podcast, the show where we discuss the latest trends, research and insights in the entertainment industry. I'm Alice Thorpe, I'm a senior analyst here at Ampere Analysis, and I'll be your host for today. On today's show, we'll be looking at the international growth strategies of the likes of Disney+, Canal+, and the BBC, and how such players are reassessing their investment priorities in response to a changing media market. And to discuss those topics today, I'm joined by my colleagues Lauren Liversedge, Sam Young, and Neil Anderson.
You're listening to the AMP podcast from Ampere Analysis. To learn more about Ampere's research across the media, games, and sports industry, head to ampereanalysis.com.
Over the past 2 years, we've seen the studio streamers becoming increasingly cautious with their spend, with content being one of their biggest cost centres. Lauren, your report focuses on Disney's changing content strategy. But firstly, can you give us a bit of a background here? What sort of landscape has prompted this change from Disney Plus in particular?
Yeah, of course. So I think that Disney Plus's changing content strategy, like you said, is a result of the broader changes in the streaming market at the moment, whereby in response to saturation of the market and economic downturn, the major streamers, including Disney Plus, are really seeing a slow in growth in subscribers. And as a result of this, they're having to shift their focus onto how they can sustain their revenue growth. In terms of Disney Plus in particular, in 2023, the number of new subscriptions to the service was down more than 70% compared to the previous year. And Disney Plus are countering this in a few ways. Firstly, trying to monetize their existing subscribers further through the introduction of ad tiers, the adjusting of their pricing structures, and as they recently announced, the crackdown on account sharing. But a big part of this strategy is also cost cutting. And as you just said, content is one of the biggest cost centers for streamers. So in an effort to cut costs where appropriate, Disney Plus have really taken a step back and have been rationalizing their content spending strategy.
So specifically in terms of content, what kind of changes are we seeing across their global footprint? And how are they kind of responding to these challenges?
I think the main thing that we're seeing is a more cautious approach to content spend. While previously Disney Plus and many of the other global streamers have invested heavily into content, after a few years of this massive output, it seems like they're realizing that this isn't sustainable. And they're now taking a step back and being more strategic with where and what they're investing in. As part of our research at Ampere, we split content spend into two main categories, which are investment on original content and investment on acquired content. In terms of original content, while this still grew last year for Disney+, the growth rate was 64% lower than the previous year. And the consequence of this is a reduced commissioning outlook, with total commissions in 2023 down 60% for Disney+. But where we're actually seeing a big cutback is on their spend on acquired content, which actually halved in 2023. So this is leading to the removal of titles on the platform, with the number of distinct movies and TV shows actually dropping for the first time in the latter half of last year.
Wow, okay, that's interesting. So how is their approach differing across different markets?
So I'll firstly speak about the acquired content. The international markets really took the brunt of these cutbacks. While there were over 200 US productions added in 2023, the number of local international titles on the platform declined by almost 15% in the latter half of the year. Now, these cutbacks were mainly focused in Europe, with Turkey, Italy, and France being worst hit. Interestingly, though, there were two key markets in Europe whose local content continued to grow on the platform, and these were Spain and the UK, with the number of titles, local titles, growing by 36 and 4% respectively. Outside of those two, South Korea and Japan also saw growth in the number of local titles, with the number of South Korean titles growing by 75% in 2023. So it does seem that while Disney Plus is cutting down on the number of titles as a whole, there are still a few key markets whose content is being prioritized, and the US is at the forefront of this. In terms of original content, commissions have come down both domestically and internationally, with Disney looking to spend more effectively on fewer titles that have a higher potential to attract viewers.
It's interesting that you mention France and Italy in particular as two countries where they're cutting back on acquired content. I'm kind of wondering whether there's a tangential relationship between that and the fact that both of those territories have very strong local content quotas in terms of the amount that these streamers are required to invest in original content. Perhaps when they can't cut back on original so severely because of the existence of a quota, they're sort of moving some of those cuts over to their acquired catalogue. But yeah, moving on from that, what kind of content exactly is it that Disney Plus is cutting back on? What kinds of shows?
So one of the main trends I noticed was to do with the portability score. So this is a term we use at Ampere, and the portability score basically measures the peak average international popularity of a title and compares it to its peak local popularity. So after comparing the portability scores of the international content that was removed from Disney Plus over the course of 2023 to the titles that stayed on the platform, what I noticed was that the average portability score of the content that stayed at the platform nearly doubled that of the content that was removed. So I think that's really interesting because it seems like Disney Plus is really trying to be very cost effective with their spending and are ensuring that the international content that they do invest in will have global appeal.
And I suppose also in terms of the portability, if we then look from the other perspective at the kind of content which they are continuing to invest in, obviously you say that the sort of the US content, which is core to their brand, is still very much there. Is this a case of Disney perhaps doubling down on some of its core US brands, which are themselves perhaps some of the most portable types of content that they have? The reason I ask is that the strength of the family-friendly Disney brand is an enormous asset, but also I think it has the potential to colour people's perception of the platform itself as carrying children and family content only. So how can Disney mitigate this going forward if they're leaning into the sort of broadest, most portable content?
Yeah, I do think you're definitely right on that. The US content on Disney Plus is by far the most popular and the most portable. For example, if you look at the top 100 most popular titles on Disney Plus globally, 95% of these were their US productions in 2023. So when you compare this to other services like Amazon at 83%, Netflix at 75%, you can see that their strengths do lie in their US productions and their Disney branded content and their franchises. That's a huge part of what attracts consumers to the service, both domestically and internationally, which could potentially cause branding issues. But I think that Disney Plus are doing quite well at mitigating this through their focus on consolidation. It seems to be a big theme for Disney Plus at the moment with the Hulu and Disney Plus merger in the US recently and the planned integration of Star Plus internationally. One thing I actually noticed was that crime and thriller stands out as the largest genre in terms of percentage of titles on both platforms. As we know, crime and thriller tend to skew towards older demographics. So I think by Disney Plus consolidating their services into a single app, they can quite effectively merge these audience demographics.
Just to come on in on that point around Disney sort of expanding from its sort of traditional family-friendly content into more adult-skewing content, it has, of course, introduced ad tiers into multiple markets. So I think it will be thinking about attracting more premium brands, particularly as it faces more constraints in terms of advertising on children's content.
Yes, that's a very good point, Neil. And given that Disney Plus is keen to maintain that appeal across a broader demographic, are there any key target territories for the future that you picked out, Lauren, in your research? What sort of markets do you think will be a focus for Disney Plus going forward?
I think that, of course, Disney Plus are still looking globally for growth. I think the main thing that has changed is just the content strategy that will help them achieve that growth. Disney Plus is reducing its investment in many international markets, but where they're continuing to invest in is South Korea, Japan, Spain, the UK, Latin America, and of course, the US. That content from all of these markets perform well locally and globally. So it seems that instead of splurging on expensive originals tailored to each international market, Disney Plus are instead focusing just on content from a few markets in each region that they know has broad appeal.
Another media player which has been closely considering its focus territories recently is Canal Plus. So the French pay TV provider has been expanding internationally over the past 5 years with investments in the likes of South Africa's MultiChoice, Hong Kong-based View, and Nordic streamer Viaplay. Sam, can you give us a bit of a background on these deals and their significance for Canal Plus? Why is the company looking increasingly to global markets for growth?
Yeah, so Canal Plus has really ramped up its investment in international markets over the past year or so. If we take a look at the group's reported revenues over the last 5 years, so from 2018 to 2023, we can see that revenues from TV in mainland France have stagnated at around 3.1 billion euros per year, whereas international TV revenues have seen a 50% increase over the same period. So in June 2023, Canal Plus took an initial 26% stake in the Asian streaming service Viu. Canal Plus since upped its stake to 30% in February 2024. In July 2023, Canal Plus acquired an initial 12% stake in the Nordic streamer Viaplay. So this followed Viaplay's Q2 results, in which it announced its intentions to exit several European markets. Again, in February 2024, Canal Plus upped its investment to nearly 30% in Viaplay. And finally, if we look at MultiChoice, the African pay TV giant, Canal Plus has been gradually increasing its stake in MultiChoice since 2020. And in February just gone, it submitted a takeover bid. So while this takeover bid was initially rejected, the two companies have since reached a proposed deal whereby Canal Plus is looking to acquire all the remaining shares in MultiChoice that it doesn't already own.
On the face of it, these are three quite different players and quite different investment choices. Where are the synergies with Canal Plus's strategy?
Yeah, so what links these three companies to Canal Plus is that they all operate in Canal Plus's core regions. So firstly, we have Viaplay in Europe. So both Canal Plus and Viaplay have significant subscriber bases across Europe. They both have a particular focus on premium content and sports rights. If we look at Viaplay's presence in Europe, its two largest markets outside of the Nordics are the Netherlands and Poland. These are key international markets for Canal Plus as well. And we can already see Canal Plus benefiting from the synergies there. So in Poland, Canal Plus sublicenses the top two Premier League games per week from Viaplay. Viaplay is leaving Poland in summer 2025, so Canal Plus will definitely be conscious of the sports rights that it holds there. In the Netherlands, Canal Plus recently launched a new OTT service in January. Among its initial content lineup, it included some Viaplay originals. And also in France, we've seen a significant increase in the number of Viaplay originals available on Canal Plus's OTT service. Secondly, we have View in Southeast Asia. So Canal Plus has around 1 million subscribers in the region. This has really stagnated in recent years. However, through this acquisition, it's become a major stakeholder in one of the leading platforms in the region. Canal Plus is already broadcasting select View series in Vietnam through its pay TV operations there. The move really highlights Canal Plus's desire to target Asia Pacific. Finally, for MultiChoice in sub-Saharan Africa, Canal Plus has been a major player there since the 90s. It really dominates in the French-speaking markets. MultiChoice, on the other hand, dominates more in English-speaking African markets. It has almost 18 million subscribers across its satellite and terrestrial pay TV operations, but it also operates an SVOD service, Showmax. So between them, the two groups hold well over half the pay TV subscriptions in the region.
It seems like the Canal Plus group is taking a very local approach to its global outlook, adjusting its strategy market by market. Lauren, how does this approach differ to the ones that the studio-backed streamers are taking?
Yeah, so the studio-backed streamers are definitely taking a more global approach. instead of going in and acquiring companies within the local markets and appealing directly to each market that they operate in, they're instead picking key markets where they can produce portable content that will appeal across the globe. As I said, studios like Disney Plus aren't able to continue producing local titles for each market. But it's not just Disney Plus in this boat. You can see with Max pulling out of the Nordics and Central Europe, Amazon pulling out of commissioning in Southeast Asia, and Paramount Plus have also said that they're going to pull back on international content investment and refocus on the Hollywood hits. So it seems to be a common trend amongst the leading streamers.
That's interesting. And Sam, how closely do you think Canal Plus is watching those kind of moves and adapting its strategy to compete with those players?
So yeah, I think Canal Plus is definitely taking a very targeted approach, maybe even opportunistic, with its global strategy. Rather than launching a single product with a blanket approach, it's not only focusing on regions where it has an existing presence. If we take into account what Lauren said, it seems to be targeting gaps where other players are withdrawing. You look at Max, which has said it will no longer produce in the Nordics and Central Eastern Europe or the Netherlands. These are all big markets for Viaplay and in turn Canal Plus. Similarly, in Southeast Asia, as Lauren said, Amazon is withdrawing from its productions in several markets there, focusing instead on big markets like India and Japan, whereas Viu has said that it wants to focus on hyperlocal content for audiences in Southeast Asia. In Africa, again, Amazon Prime has said that it will be scaling back on its operations on the continent. Again, that's a key region for Canal Plus.
Sub-Saharan Africa is probably where Canal Plus has the strongest international foothold, as you mentioned. What is it about its strategy that it's meant it has been able to succeed there, where perhaps a big streamer like Amazon has struggled?
I think the value in Sub-Saharan Africa for Canal Plus is its pay TV market. Pay TV subscriptions are forecast to continue to grow and overshadow OTT subscriptions for the foreseeable future. Obviously, pay TV has historically been Canal Plus's core business line. By comparison, if you look at pay TV market in Europe, subscriptions have stagnated in recent years. If we look at Canal Plus's investments in Africa beyond MultiChoice, it's recently acquired a stake in a Senegalese production company, Maraudi TV. They're currently working on developing original programming in local languages, so in Pula languages, which is spoken across Senegal, Guinea, and Mali. It also is a major stakeholder in Rock Studios in Nigeria, Plan A Studios in the Ivory Coast. So all of this really supports its local content offering. Obviously, Africa has a huge French-speaking population as well, so Canal Plus can lean on its enormous French catalogue there. That is the real strength of the region for Canal Plus.
And in terms of closer to home, as you say, you've got those stagnating pay TV revenues in a lot of European territories. Is there still room for growth there?
So if we look at Canal Plus's home territory of France, we did see subscriber losses during the latter half of the 2010s there. However, it has since returned to subscriber growth. So elsewhere in Europe, what Canal Plus now is looking to do is to consolidate its activities under its Canal Plus brand. It's so far launched platforms in Poland, Austria, Slovakia, Czech Republic, and most recently in the Netherlands.
We've talked about the ambitions of streaming and pay TV players, but how about broadcasters? How can they adapt their strategies to grow amidst strong competition from streamers? Last month, the BBC's Director General announced its intention to seek more partnerships with streaming services in the future. Neil, what's prompted this move from the BBC?
Yeah, so traditional broadcasters like the BBC are facing a common challenge. So as audiences have migrated to streaming, the nature of competition has changed and local broadcasters kind of lack the scale to be able to compete with global streaming platforms. They ultimately have deeper pockets when it comes to investing in content. So to remain relevant and competitive, the BBC's Director General, Tim Davey, announced strategic plans to help secure its long-term future. Now, this includes plans to rebuild its online platforms, to improve its content strategy, and also to place more focus on growing its commercial revenues as it deals with a cut to its budget effectively. This also comes at a time where there has been a lot of uncertainty around the BBC's TV license funding model. And the UK government is considering the best way to fund public service broadcasting going forward. So kind of against that backdrop, a key strategy for the BBC will be forming content partnerships in a bid to secure more third-party funding for some of its content.
We've already seen a potential template for how this might work, I suppose, in the BBC's global distribution deal with Disney Plus for Doctor Who. What are the benefits for the BBC here for those kind of deals?
Yeah, so Tim Davey actually pointed to the co-production deal with Disney for Doctor Who as a good blueprint for how the BBC can keep funding content while also managing costs. So the BBC struck the co-production deal with Disney in 2022, and that's for the latest season of Doctor Who, which I believe is set to premiere next month. And under this agreement, the show will be distributed on Disney Plus outside of the UK, which ultimately extends the show's reach globally. Crucially, partnership brings with it some Disney money to direct towards the show's production, allowing for upgrades like a flashier TARDIS for the Doctor to travel in. Fans will also be expecting improved special effects and set design as well. So this really comes as a welcome relief for the BBC, helping to alleviate some of those budget constraints. And that sort of boost in the production quality also means that Doctor Who might have that ability then as a franchise to compete with high budget sci-fi productions that we've seen over the last few years, including things like Stranger Things. So there's an opportunity here for Doctor Who to reach new audiences internationally, given the global reach of Disney Plus.
And if we flip that round, what are the benefits for a streamer of taking on a kind of established show like Doctor Who and taking that globally across its platform?
So we've seen that IP has really become a new prime commodity in the streaming market. And tapping into those sort of recognisable franchises can really help reach loyal fan bases and ultimately drive subscribers. Through securing distribution rights to Doctor Who, Disney Plus adds another franchise to its roster, which already includes things like Star Wars, Marvel, and Pixar. And Doctor Who's sort of wide global fan base and long-standing popularity in international markets, which has been cultivated through those sort of international distribution deals, really positions it as a sort of valuable asset in the streaming market. I think there's also potential to grow the wider franchise, or the Hooniverse, as I believe it's called, to include spin-off series. And this will be an interesting one to watch, given Disney's strategy of expanding franchises through prequels and spin-offs.
Now, presumably, there are only so many homegrown properties which have the kind of established international reach that Doctor Who had when Disney Plus and the BBC started to hash out this deal. So are there any other examples of broadcasters doing this globally that you can think of?
Yeah, so I think that the scale of this deal means that it's pretty unprecedented, given the fact that there's been reports around the show receiving around £10 million per episode. So it really does sound like Disney has put a lot of money behind the show. I think the issue for any other opportunities here are that there are few broadcaster franchises, as you say, that kind of lack the global appeal that Doctor Who has. And broadcasters ultimately, of course, focus on local markets, so they haven't necessarily been too concerned with developing global franchises in the same way that the US studios have. That being said, distribution deals and co-financing are fairly commonplace, where international broadcasters or SVOD services help fund a programme in exchange for distribution rights. The BBC has pursued similar arrangements before, such as the co-commission of His Dark Materials, with HBO holding international rights. I think streamers haven't explored this as much. Netflix typically prefers to be the sole commissioner of its titles, but it has explored some co-funding and co-commissions with broadcasters, like the collaboration between Netflix and Canal Plus for the thriller series The Spy, or with Atres Media for early seasons of Money Heist. Netflix has also partnered with some broadcasters in India and Japan, so there is some potential here. What we've actually seen more of is streamers taking over broadcaster shows independently, like Netflix did with both Top Boy and Black Mirror, which first started out on Channel 4. So we'll see if there's more deals that are similar to this. But as I said, there's not any properties that really have the global scale that Doctor Who has.
Out of interest, there may not be so many properties that have that global scale already. But are there any kind of more under the radar pieces of IP that you've identified that might have the potential to be quote unquote franchised by a deal with a bigger streamer?
Yeah, so I have given this some thought. As I said, nothing really has that global appeal in the same way that Doctor Who has, but there is maybe potential for future partnerships involving UK shows that have already achieved global attention. So perhaps some drama reboots or spin-offs from Peaky Blinders, Sherlock, or Downton Abbey. Personally, I'd like to maybe see a reboot of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy with a bit of Disney money behind it, which actually first started out as a BBC radio drama. Or maybe ITV teaming up with a streaming platform for a Primeval reboot. I think that probably could have done with a bump in its special effects budget. Lastly, this might be a bit left field, but perhaps a crossover between White Lotus and Fawlty Towers could be making its way to HBO Max one day soon. I wouldn't bank on it.
That is an interesting one. In terms of these kinds of global distribution deals, are there any disadvantages here against just licensing the content internationally on a sort of a territory by territory basis?
Yeah, so I think a distribution deal like the one between the BBC and Disney is not necessarily a win-win situation. There are some trade-offs for the BBC. The main one being the long-term content trading relationships that the BBC has built up with broadcast partners internationally. So this Disney deal means that international broadcasters like ABC in Australia and Bell in Canada are missing out on rights to Doctor Who after holding them for decades. So that is a trade-off that the BBC will have to consider. There's also a question around how both parties, Disney and the BBC, will measure the success of the deal. Will Doctor Who bring in new audiences and build up a loyal fan base in new markets? Or will it just sit on Disney Plus alongside the other franchises and not really have its moment? So yeah, I think both parties here will be looking at how this partnership develops. And I think the wider industry will also be keeping an eye on how the show performs.
Lauren, with the cutbacks on content spend that you mentioned, do you envision distribution deals like this one becoming more or less common?
Honestly, I think it's a bit of a toss-up. Of course, Doctor Who was a great move for Disney Plus, but looking ahead, I'm not sure it will become commonplace. Disney Plus is scaling back its spend on acquired content. As I said, it's likely they're going to be quite selective about where they invest in. And again, as Neil said, with a small pool of potential titles available, I wouldn't expect this to become the norm. Although I'm sure if an opportunity arose to access an established international fan base, I'm sure they would take the opportunity.
Finally, Neil, just to touch on some of the kind of questions around growing broadcaster commercial revenue that you highlighted at the top. What other avenues to supporting growth are there open to broadcasters? Will we be seeing the likes of the BBC leaning more on their commercial studio business, for example?
Yeah, so revenue diversification is a key strategy for many broadcasters globally as they deal with that decline in their and stagnation in their traditional revenue sources. And for the BBC, the director's general speech actually touched on the BBC's need to expand its commercial arm, BBC Studios, as a way to help support the delivery of its services. Several strategies are already in place. It's of course looking to grow its production capabilities, doubling BBC Studios' revenue by 2028. It's looking to transition its children's production to BBC Studios to boost its potential in the global kids content market. It's also looking to strengthen BritBox International, as a means to grow direct-to-consumer relationships globally, leaning on that global brand that the BBC has. It's also, interestingly, looking to introduce advertising on its BBC podcasts on commercial platforms like Apple and Spotify. So although the BBC has strategies for growing its commercial revenue, I think much of the future of the BBC's position in the market depends on its future funding model post-2028, when the current agreement comes to an end, which is likely going to change given the arguments around the licence fee system being regressive and that it's a flat tax against households. I think for the BBC, it's really trying to demonstrate its commitment to commercial growth, to global growth, and of course, finding new ways to finance its content.
And I'm sure, no broadcaster is immune to the kinds of economic pressures that are being felt in the market right now. And we'll be seeing a lot more public broadcasters taking these kind of strategies and looking more globally to shore up their revenue and their global position. Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to all our guests for their time and for sharing their research with us. We've heard from Lauren about how Disney Plus is reassessing its international content strategy, from Sam about how Canal Plus is looking globally for growth, and from Neil about potential future partnerships between local broadcasters and global streamers. If you haven't already done so, make sure you're subscribed to the AMP podcast, as well as our weekly newsletter. And for more on Ampere's research and services, head to ampereanalysis.com. Or you can get in touch by emailing info@ampereanalysis.com. That's info@ampereanalysis.com. I'm Alice Thorpe, and I've been your host for today, and the producer of this episode was Rory Goodrick. We hope you enjoyed, and thank you very much for listening.